In-depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Usable news and information for your job. And now, here's Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program for Friday, May 17th, 2013, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. And I am very pleased to have on the Federal News Countdown two people who are experts in the world of the federal government. This week it is Dan Blair of the National Academy of Public Administration. It's great to see you again, my friend.
Good to see you, Francis.
And you are, of course, a veteran of the Federal News Countdown. We have a rookie on the program this week, so we have to make sure that we're very careful and deliberate in helping him through the process of the Federal News Countdown, Dan.
I'll choose my words very carefully.
General Dale Myros is the president and founder of the Myros Group. General, it's great to see you. Thanks
Good
for coming.
Good to see you again, Francis. Thanks for having me.
Happy to do it. You chose your stories like you know what you're doing on this thing.
Well,
these are terrific.
You know, D.C.'s got a lot of stories going right now.
No shortage of things to talk about this week, and we start on the Federal News Countdown with...
Number 3!
The third most important story, as chosen by Dale Myros, is from Information Week. The headline is, Federal CIOs Identify Budget Cut Risks. And this is something you and I have talked about before. This is the idea that CIOs are asking for budget autonomy. Some of them are starting to get it, and maybe it's going to be a lot harder job than they expected when they first asked for it.
Oh, absolutely. There are a couple things that struck me about this story, and some of it is some of these lines never go away. The element about resources. I mean, you know, for my entire federal career, every year was a resource crunch in some ways, shape, or form with regards to priorities. Second thing that struck me about this particular article is that the CIOs actually identified what I call the 80-20 rule. They spend 80% of their money on providing existing services and 20% on building towards the future. And as I've come to find out over the years, particularly in business, if you're stuck at 80-20, then you're probably just barely holding your own. That you ought to strive for something like a 70-30, or depending upon the type of organization you are, maybe even a 60-40 with regard to spending on legacy and running operations versus planning for the future.
So what does that say about where you think we stand today? That, I mean, from that kind of a ratio standpoint, it sounds like we might be in a little bit of trouble.
I think if we don't change it, we're going to be in a bit of trouble. Again, if you continue to look through the article, a couple of other things stand out in that regard. And one is what a lot of people don't realize is that most of the CIOs in the federal government, at best, control half of their IT expenditures, which means that the other half are in the functionals, the other parts of the organization. So when the pressure comes down on the CIO to reduce organizational IT spend, in essence, he's starting with a half a denominator from what he ought to be able to look at. And so that comes out in this article. And in current day discussion, I mean, I think that's playing out very well.
Dale Myros is the third most important federal news story of the week is from Information Week. The headline is Federal CIOs Identify Budget Cut Risks. Dan Blair, your third most important story is headline CBO Sees Brighter Economy with Budget Deficit to Plunge $642 billion this year. It's from the Washington Post. And this is kind of a shocker. I mean, people thought that that the deficit would stay in the $1 trillion range for quite a long time. This is a quite a come down, and that's really good news, I suppose.
It is a very good news story. I thought the choice of words for the reporter, plummet to $642 billion, was interesting. But I think that this is definitely good news. But I think that we need to temper this by looking at the long-term forecast. And if you look at it later, it says that the deficits will gradually begin rising again as baby boom generations tap into Social Security, Medicare. And the other part of this story is that the debt, I understand, our national debt will still rise by $800 billion this year. So this isn't something to go out and, you know, we have a long way to go towards addressing this. The other thing that I thought was important about this is it's my understanding that the CBO bases this on Congress not doing anything to increase spending or cancel sequestration. And so we've seen that there's going to be a lot of pressure on Congress. And with a cursory view of this, it looks like, oh, there might be some more money to spend. And if there is, then I think that our prognostications of a smaller deficit would go away. So this is good news, but it's going to be affected by what Congress does over the next in the short term and the long term.
Given the context that you outlined there, Dan, this story is, while interesting and while the headline is sounds like a positive step, might not really mean a whole lot if you consider that along with my colleague Jared Serbu's story from yesterday on federalnewsradio.com, where he highlights the fact that the Defense Department budget, for example, none of the three models that are out there right now are anywhere close to the budget control number, budget control act number. So we're looking at sequestration again in fiscal 2014, and then based on what you just said, this number goes out the window.
Well, it builds sequestration to the baseline.
Mm-hmm.
And so if deficit reduction is going to be on the front burner, it's going to, you know, signal to the agencies that this new order that we have, that we've seen ourselves in over the course of this year, will be the new normal for definitely the short term, if not for the longer term.
That may not be a bad thing, though, because at least we know what the new normal is going to be. I mean, and uncertainty is something that we've covered on this show a lot as being pretty disruptive for leaders in government.
Uncertainty is extremely disruptive. The question is going to be, are agencies going to have the appropriate resources? One thing I'd like to find out, and I haven't seen anything on this, is, you know, sequestration is, you know, comes out of specific accounts within the agencies. How many agencies have asked for reprogramming authority to say, look, we don't need X in this, but we really need to do Y, and will the appropriators allow us to take money from one pot and put it to another? I haven't seen those. OMB has to approve those requests going through. I think that's an interesting question, and I don't have an answer for that.
The third most important federal news story of the week, according to Dan Blair, is for the Washington Post. The headline is CBO sees brighter economy with budget deficit plunged to $642 billion this year. You can read all the stories we're counting down this week at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, and we'll be back with the second most important federal news story of the week from Dan Blair and from Dale Myros on the Federal News Countdown. This is In Depth with Francis Rose.
Ray Brown, Division Chief for Enterprise Server Operations Centers, U.S. Department of State, on the Federal Executive Forum on Virtualization and Data Center Consolidation, sponsored by Unicom Government.
Network security, perimeter security is a high priority issue for us, and it's an important issue because as we grow in our capacity to offer citizen services and diplomacy throughout the world, that network, external network access, is growing.
To listen to the whole program made possible by Trezza Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Unicom Government, a division of Unicom Global, is a trusted NetApp partner in the federal government. Together, they enable maximum storage efficiencies by allowing federal agencies to store rapidly growing data without straining resources or budgets. Visit unicomgov.com today to learn how their storage solutions can help your federal agency. That's www.unicomgov.com.
Do you think about energy efficiency? You should. Technology exists now that can save your company a bundle on energy, make your business more competitive and sustainable, and make you look like an efficiency guru. See it live at Experience Efficiency, an interactive event coming to D.C. in June. Explore innovative new solutions that will change the way we all work, learn, and play. To register for this free event, go to Schneider-Electric.com.
How are the VA and HUD working together to end homelessness among veterans? What does it mean to pursue a housing-first approach to ending veteran homelessness? And how are the VA and HUD raising awareness about available programs for those most at risk? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and more with two special guests, Susan Angel from the VA and Mark Johnston from HUD, next week on the Business of Government Hour.
This is NIH Health Matters. I'm Joe Balinti. May is Healthy Vision Month.
There are a lot of things we can do to keep our eyes healthy.
Dr. Rachel Bishop at NIH says that includes eating right and maintaining a healthy weight.
The advice that we get to keep our heart healthy and keep our body healthy, we've learned applies just as well to the eyes. And in terms of diet, there are specific things we've learned are helpful.
She adds that green leafy vegetables like kale and spinach have nutrients that are helpful for the eyes. Research is also showing that omega-3 fatty acids found in fish are also healthy for the eyes. For more eye health details, visit www.nei.nih.gov. Health Matters is produced by NIH, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Agencies are constantly told to be innovative, but what does that mean? I'm Emily Kopp. On Monday's Federal Drive, we'll look at innovation at the National Archives, where volunteers are helping the agency catalog its treasure trove. And former Homeland Security official John Whitley tells us how DHS could make the border more secure with data. It all starts at 6 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And for the latest federal news, check out federalnewsradio.com.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, federalnewsradio.com. The three most important federal news stories of the week. Up for discussion on the Federal News Countdown this week, Dan Blair from NAPA and Dale Myros, the Myros Group, the experts choosing the stories this week, and we're up to
number two.
The second most important federal news story of the week is selected by Dale Myros, is from the ABA Journal, and the headline is, "Stunned by $45 million cyber heist, banks have limited options for trying to recover money." The implication here, Dale, for the federal government is what when it comes to something like this that happens in the private sector?
Well, as you and I have often talked, the Yellen, about having policies, having laws in place and things like that. So just imagine if this $45 million was stolen by bank robbers with guns and they broke in, and we would feel very confident of how you do the DNA and how you do the evidence and what you do with them if you get them and things like that. This points out what you and I have talked about many times with regard to federal policy and legislation and even treaty implication. And so that I thought it was important for that. For the second my second reason for thinking was important is that this makes the story more real to people. As in, they can relate. Somebody stole $45 million. They did it with cyber business. And how often have we talked about not being able to tell the cyber story in a way that relates to people? Well, here's an instance. And okay, so what's not available in the instance? Tools, ability to search and seizure of evidence, the ability to go across law enforcement lines or even state lines or international boundaries or whatever. And it's a perfect case of how the threat today is one more of theft, advanced persistent threat, than breaking and entering.
Mm-hmm. I saw what Dale saw in this story also, Dan, but the other thing that occurred to me is that there's the connection here is people understanding that all kinds of critical infrastructure can be under attack. And in this case, it's their own stuff. It's their, I mean, the bank's not just holding its own money, it's holding money theoretically for depositors. And so folks can see that and see this is for real and this is not just something that we hear about at a level that doesn't make any sense to us.
Well, one of the things my takeaway from this was, do we have the legal infrastructure and regulatory structure in place, I mean, to deal with something like this and to deal with these kinds of threats? It's always that we're always catching up, and individuals like this who perpetrated this are thinking ahead and say, how do we do things differently to make ourselves successful in engaging in this kind of crime? And with technology changing as rapidly, you know, 40 years ago, you could do a quick fix maybe or change some you could do infrastructure change. And even though it was slow, you could respond to those emerging threats. Now it takes a matter of days, weeks, or months, and the new technology is jumping ahead. And so this really raises questions of what kind of infrastructure do we need and what kind of flexibilities do we need to deal with these emerging threats as they occur.
Is it possible to get ahead of a threat like this, Dale, or are we always going to be playing catch up because the bad guys are more creative than the good guys at figuring out ways to do bad stuff?
Well, as you know, I'm an optimist, but I've yet to see the evidence to give me a reason to be optimistic. And so it's the element of innovation. And so, you know, can the good guys out-innovate the bad guys? And even if you do it at the same pace, the good guys aren't ahead of the bad guys in doing it. But let me make what I think is an important point. We often talk about hackers and cyberspace as these are the techie guys over here. Let's make no mistake, these are bank robbers first and foremost. They just use cyber as the element of stealing $45 million.
Well, and that's the thing that we always talk about when it comes to the IT infrastructure in government, is that it's not a thing in and of itself. It's the tool to accomplish the mission of the agency. And so it strikes me that people in government get that now better than ever. And I wonder why it's taken us a little bit more time in the cyber realm to adopt that same worldview, the way that we think about approaching something
sure.
like this.
And my quick answer to that, although inadequate, is that most of the time when people hear the word cyber or somebody starts talking about cyber, they immediately think of Department of Defense, intelligence community, government. That's not me. And if you and I have always talked, anytime you connect to cyberspace, you're not a pedestrian. You are, in fact, a part of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. The human element has been the most difficult thing for agencies to crack on this, and not among their IT staffs, but among everybody else, to get them to understand, Dan, exactly what Dale is saying, which is you, person who is not part of the IT department, when you stick the thumb drive in the computer that's got infected software on it, you're part of the problem here. You're a threat now, and that insider threat, as much as the person wasn't intending to be, is turning out to be as big a problem as just about anything else.
Well, that's why it has to be inculcated into the agencies. I think FISMA, the Federal Information Security Management Act, tried to do that. It was a good step towards that. But I think we need to look at that and see how we can update that. I think Congress has been looking at that as well. But you need to look at what the IGs do in terms of this. We just completed a report with SafeGov looking at some of the ways that the IGs could improve cybersecurity using the FISMA infrastructure instead of having to have a legislative change. But the bottom line is that, as you said, General, that you're a participant once you log on, and that it's a very interesting environment out there, and that you'll have, while this may not have been as sophisticated, I'm not sure the level of sophistication, stealing from ATMs may require quite a bit because of the credit card transactions or the ATM card transactions. But, you know, we're seeing cyber attacks all the time aimed at agencies and businesses. I mean, That's the big thing, is that the cyber attacks on businesses and the espionage that's going on in the business community from outside sources, and everything, you know, points to, you know, what was it? They pinpointed that building in Shanghai. So we're going to see a lot more of this as time goes on.
Dan, I think you make some great points there. As you probably know, Congressman Issa, through his committee, has gotten several FISMA follow-on things about continuous monitoring and things like that. But like much of the mm-hmm. other cyber legislation, it seems to take a back seat to a lot of other activities on Capitol Hill.
Dale Myros' second most important federal news story of the week is from the ABA Journal. It is a headline, "Stunned by $45 million cyber heist, banks have limited options for trying to recover the money." And you can find it and all of our stories on the Federal News Countdown this week at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Dan Blair's second most important federal news story of the week is next on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
The year was 1930. The epic flight that had made Charles Lindbergh a superstar was in the history books, and the Spirit of St. Louis was in the Smithsonian. But Lucky Lindy had his sights on a new challenge, a nonstop flight across the U.S. To accomplish this feat, he needed more than luck. He needed a new plane. For that, he turned to Lockheed, where under his watchful eye, the Lockheed Sirius took shape. In April of that year, with his wife Anne Morrow Lindbergh acting as co-pilot, he took off from Los Angeles and arrived in New York City a mere 14 hours, 45 minutes, 32 seconds later. They'd broken the record by 3 hours. 60 years later, another museum-bound aircraft, Lockheed Martin's SR-71, crossed the country in just over 1 hour and took its place alongside the Spirit of St. Louis. Their stories are our stories. See them unfold at LockheedMartin.com/100 years.
Are you a civilian employee of the intelligence community, the Department of Defense, or the Department of State? You may be eligible for term life insurance from GEBA, the Government Employees Benefit Association, with coverage issued by the Prudential Insurance Company of America. Term life insurance helps provide security for your family in case something happens to you. It's money to pay your mortgage or your children's college expenses, or help ensure your spouse can retire in comfort. GEBA's group life plan offers affordable rates with coverage amounts up to $600,000. Civilian employees of the intelligence community, the Department of Defense, or the Department of State. Don't let these exclusive benefits pass you by. Start planning today and get peace of mind for your family and protection for their future. Visit GEBA.com/termlife to learn more or to download an enrollment form. That's GEBA.com/termlife. Group term life coverage for GEBA is issued by the Prudential Insurance Company of America, 751 Broad Street, Newark, New Jersey, 07102. Contract series 83500.
The secret to being successful is never slowing down. Your agency's mission doesn't have a pause button, and with CenturyLink as your trusted technology partner, you don't have to slow down. Their visionary cloud infrastructure and custom communication solutions are backed by dedicated responsive support. Pause button not included. To learn more about how CenturyLink keeps you up and rolling 24/7, 365, visit CenturyLink.com/gov. That's CenturyLink.com/gov.
Exercise and depression. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss. With HHS HealthBeat, exercise can reduce C-reactive protein, or CRP, a marker of inflammation. Higher levels of CRP can signal a higher risk of heart disease and other conditions like type 2 diabetes. But one study indicates people with symptoms of depression don't reduce CRP through exercise. At Duke Medicine, Edward Suarez compared CRP levels in people who were active or sedentary.
The sedentaries that were depressed had the same level of CRP as those who were active but yet depressed.
But Suarez says being active does other good things, so people who are depressed should still be physically active. The study in the journal Brain, Behavior, and Immunity was supported by the National Institutes of Health. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
Join WTOP for the Washington Animal Rescue League's Adopt-A-Thon, Saturday, June 1st and Sunday, June 2nd from 11 a.m. until 5 p.m.
More than 150 rescue dogs and cats that need forever homes will be available for adoption at discounted fees.
All dogs, cats, puppies, and kittens have been spayed or neutered, microchipped, and are ready to be part of your family.
Help us save lives, Saturday, June 1st, Sunday, June 2nd. Visit WARL.org for more information.
Now for your Federal News Radio cybersecurity update, brought to you by CenturyLink, afternoons at 30 minutes after the hour. Four members of the Lull Security Group are going to prison after pleading guilty to hacking charges in London. The harshest sentence issued to 21-year-old Ryan Cleary, who will spend 32 months in prison for hacking into Air Force computers at the Pentagon. You get your cybersecurity update afternoons at 30 minutes after the hour on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, this week selected by Dale Myros and Dan Blair. And Dan, your second most important federal news story of the week is headline, DOD poised to trim furlough days and add exemptions, from the Associated Press. This is in some ways a good news story because DOD started out at 22 days, cut back to 14, now back to 11, and the door is actually still open that this could get smaller yet.
Even with the door open, you know, it is somewhat of a good news story if you were looking at being laid off for 3 weeks, you know, 21 days, which is essentially a month, mm-hmm. versus, you know, half a month. I guess that's good. But if you're one of those workers, you're sitting there thinking, you know, what am I going to have to trim and cut back?
Yeah.
It really does take a toll on the defense workers, and I don't think that that should ever be forgotten when we talk about this, because these are real people, and, you know, there's a lot of bureaucrat bashing that goes on. But these are people who have really dedicated themselves to federal service. And it's interesting we're talking about this because we're coming up on Public Service Recognition Week. And there have been a lot of stories about the feds this week, you know, some not so good. But we got to remember those people who really work hard on behalf of the United States and recognize them and thank them for their service. But if you look at what DOD is doing and then compare it across the federal government, it shows that this is sequester so uneven when it comes to furloughing employees. And it's you know, it raises to me an issue of overall management. It's like, why should one agency like Commerce Department said as of May 9th, no employees had been furloughed and that details are so forthcoming? You know, some are furloughing, some aren't. And this unevenness across agency seems to kind of defy the fact that we really need to have a holistic approach to these human capital management issues. One thing I thought was interesting, though, is in looking at the furlough days and what was going on across government agency by agency, there was another article this week that talked about how MSPB rejected one of the DOD union's pleas for an advisory opinion on furloughs. I thought that was kind of creative, going to the MSPB and saying, you know, this is illegal and you need to stop it. And MSPB basically said, we don't issue advisory opinions. But I think it's interesting. I think there's going to be a lot more efforts over the summer to try to peel off individual agencies or individual groups of employees to make sure that safety and public health and a whole host of issues, inherently government issues, those programs are fully funded to the extent that's necessary to protect the public.
Now, the two agencies that I most closely associate you with, Dale, Department of Defense and ODNI, taking this week very dramatically different approaches to the furlough situation. Dan talked about DOD. General Clapper saying no furloughs in the intelligence community and explaining why. He said, we've been planning for this for a long time, and we've spent our money accordingly, and we're not going to have to do it. The two things that struck me about what Secretary Hagel said, one of them was, as I mentioned, he kind of left the door open that furloughs could – the 11's not necessarily mm-hmm. the final number. The other was that he was very careful to say – that we're all in this together, and so the fact that some services could potentially avoid them doesn't mean they're going to be able to. We're all going to do this the same way. Did that surprise you?
No, it didn't. And the department often stands united in that. Unlike, as you know, the intelligence community has two allegiances, one to the department of which they're part of and the intelligence community, and their programs are set up differently. And so they had a degree of flexibility in addition to doing some good work and planning. But I'd like to pick up on something Dan said very quickly, and it's the unevenness. And if you're talking about a lower-ranking person, I know a lot has been made about the size of some of the salaries of the more senior people in government and all those other kinds of – that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the younger folks that are struggling to make a rent payment, a mortgage payment, car payment, kids in school, young, and all those kinds of things, and furlough. What that really means is you get paid less. And so your ability to meet your obligations, and if you're on a razor's edge to begin with, that only gets worse for you. So you got to think, what is this going to do for retention of the workforce and talent further on down the line?
Well, and recruitment's an issue here, too. I'm starting here. I had Catherine Medina, the Chief Human Capital Officers Council, here on Wednesday, and she said this is a potential recruitment problem, too, because, first of all, people who aren't paying attention to the federal government on a daily basis hear hiring freeze. Well, if there's a hiring freeze, what do I apply for? Why bother if there's no jobs? That's not the case, but that's what people hear who don't follow it on a daily basis. And then, as we've talked about, and you made that point eloquently, Dale, people are hearing pay freeze for the last 3 years, and if I go in there, maybe I'm going to be furloughed at some point in time, and I don't make as much money as I think I'm going to, and all those kinds of things. And that must just wreak havoc on the people in the HR community, Dan.
Well, I think again, we were talking about certainty, and this just adds more elements of uncertainty to what I think federal workers really want, that certainty that they'll forgo a lot of things, and like their private sector brethren, because they want that certainty in employment. But I think we need to keep things in perspective here. State government employees go through, and city government employees across the country have historically gone through furloughs on quite a regular basis. So this isn't uncommon for government. It's very uncommon. I guess we've had pockets here and pockets there in the federal government over the years, but this kind of widespread furloughing, I don't think has ever taken place. I might be wrong, but I don't remember it in my 28 years here in D.C. But it also drives home to me, we've been talking about sequester now for, we knew that this was an option that was out there. There was, you know, I look at this and go, what planning was taking place, and is this the best way of meeting the absolute numbers? I don't have an answer to that, but it's a question. And that's where this furlough seemed to inflict quite a bit of pain.
But remember, the administration was saying back in October, November, December, don't plan for sequestration, almost as though they were forbidding agencies to plan for sequestration. What I thought was ironic, Dale, was it sounded yesterday that General Clapper didn't listen. That's right. And I'm sure you're familiar with his train of thought that didn't surprise you very much either, probably. But
that's a question I have, is what could have been done differently. Mm-hmm. In a sequester environment, and how much planning and attention was paid to this. I mean, it certainly was out there, but this is, you know, whatever happened before, the brunt is being borne by the everyday worker out there, and I think this is something to think about.
The second most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Dan Blair, is from the Associated Press. The headline is DOD poised to trim furlough days and add exemptions, and you can read it and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Dan Blair and by Dale Myros, as we continue next on the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose.
As the U.S. government adopts cloud services, virtualization, and other technologies, it must also look toward an integrated and enhanced network infrastructure. HP Converged Infrastructure, with the Flex Network architecture as the cornerstone, can revolutionize how data centers are built. Using a standards-based approach, HP Networking delivers a simpler, more secure infrastructure, enables agile service delivery, and drives business value from core to edge. Combined with HP servers, storage, and services, HP Networking protects businesses across physical and virtual environments, delivers application services in minutes versus days, and reduces networking costs. The HP Converged Infrastructure integrates servers, storage, and networking, eliminating technology silos and freeing up resources so you can focus on innovation. To plan your strategy or to learn about their open flow-enabled edge switches with full lifetime warranty and no licensing required, talk to an HP representative at 800-277-8988. That's 800-277-8988.
Are you a federal employee or government contractor? FederalNewsRadio.com is the best source for news that helps you do your job better. Our news team brings you the latest on federal pay and benefits, technology, defense, retirement, acquisition, and the federal budget as it's happening. FederalNewsRadio.com gives a voice to the federal community. Read and hear interviews with federal leaders, members of Congress, and industry. Find it all at FederalNewsRadio.com. And while you're there, don't forget to sign up for our breaking news email alerts.
Newsmakers on the Federal Drive, weekday morning, 6 to 10.
Gabe Rotman is legislative and policy advisor to the Washington office of the ACLU.
When it comes to an exception for whistleblower protections in the national security agencies, that's exactly the wrong place to have such a protection. And whistleblowers are often the only way that the public can find out about government wrongdoing in those agencies.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/federaldrive.
You're listening to Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, and federalnewsradio.com. Now your DoD report, brought to you by BAE Systems, afternoons at 40 minutes past the hour. Rules in the Defense Federal Acquisition Regulation Supplement, or DFARS, may change to secure the electronic supply chain. The Defense Department proposes new requirements to hold contractors responsible for detecting and reporting counterfeit IT supplies. Comments on the proposal are due by July 15th. You get your DoD report, brought to you by BAE Systems, afternoons at 40 minutes past the hour, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, and federalnewsradio.com.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Dale Myros and by Dan Blair, and we're up to
number one.
The very top of the chart. Dale, your most important federal news story of the week is from the New York Times. The headline is Cyber Attacks Against U.S. Corporations Are on the Rise. And I have to confess, I read the headline, of course, before I read the story, and my response to that headline was, duh. No big shock there. So what are we learning now that we didn't know before?
Well, there are a couple things I thought significant. First of all, this is New York Times. And how often is it that we talk from trade journals and folks? And so New York Times is general publication. Second of all, this is the first time that there's been a warning put out by this administration after the presidential executive order. So that process got exercised for the first time. And in fact, in the press, we weren't exactly sure what to read of it or how to take it. And if you read that article, that comes out. Third of all, and this might be most important. Again, as you and I have talked, 85% of critical infrastructure in this country is in private ownership. So what responsibilities does the government have versus an industry versus a citizenry with respect to protecting this? And now we're getting back to public confidence in government. And so the issues of public confidence in government in other discussions will play over into public discussions with government with respect to cyber in much the same way.
And something, Dale, that Dan and I have talked about before is what the expectation that citizens have of government. That fits exactly with what you're talking about. It also fits with your number two story about the money being stolen from banks, because my sense is that a lot of people probably would not necessarily draw the bank robber to cyber robber conclusion that you did accurately, but they probably would draw the conclusion that a crime happened and somebody from the government at some level should do something or should have done something about it. And so, again, that seems to me also that fits this whole what's the role of government in this situation, complicated by the fact that they don't control the infrastructure. They don't own it.
Absolutely. And if I could make one other point, which is, again, a part of this continual discussion, is that the early reporting of this is it does not emanate from China. And in the cyber discussions of the past several months, we've become preoccupied with the apparent and supposed threat that China does. I don't want to minimize that, but there are other bad actors out there, and the cast of characters are the usual cast of characters, irrespective of whether you're talking about diplomatic, economic, or cyber issues.
The most interesting observation that came out of all of this talk about China recently, especially the Mandiant report, was, I don't remember if it was you or someone else that I talked to, one of my other cyber experts, but the observation was that this report may only mean that of all the very critical threats that we face, the Chinese threat may be the worst because they're the ones that are easiest for us to detect, that we could pinpoint it to one particular building that they don't mind that we know, and the others, and I'm not going to throw them out there, but as you say, Dale, they're the obvious ones, they're better. Because they don't leave tracks behind that are as easy for us to chase around.
And it's easier for them to hide in plain sight, as it were.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask a question. What do you do about this? What happens if our grid gets shut down, our electrical grid gets shut down by a cyber attack, and we know who did it? What do we do about that? I mean, this isn't your typical act of war.
Sure.
of putting people, you know, of killing people, but if you shut down all the traffic lights in D.C. at 4:30 in the afternoon, it's going to be chaos, and it's not going to be pretty.
Sure.
So I don't know how do you respond to this?
Let me offer a couple of thoughts. First of all, when an emergency happens, I am not all that concerned about attribution. I'm concerned with outcomes and effects. So how do I recover? I worry about attribution for preventing it in the future or for retribution afterwards. But attribution is not necessarily important for solving the problem. Second of all, it is impossible to shut down the North American grid or the grid of the United States across the board all at once, simply because of how it's organized, set up, and controlled. And then the third point is we've already experienced some of this. Let me give you some quick examples. Remember in 2002 when the entire Northeast power grid went down, it was a malfunction in Cleveland of a control switch of production that came out of Canada. And so it took us 3 or 4 days to recover that. Remember, I think it was in 2005 or 6, one of the satellite links went down, to which you could not process credit cards at gas stations and supermarkets and things like that. So we have experienced the symptoms of cyber attacks in many forms over time in several different types of emergencies that were precipitated by something other than a specific cyber attack, a maintenance, an outage, equipment malfunction. The element of what would it do to our air traffic control system, I don't think a cyber attack on the air traffic control system can wreak any more havoc than God does with the weather. Because if you look at the number of planes and all those other kinds of things that get delayed or canceled and people inconvenienced and money lost and things like that because of weather, and we have had some small minor outages in the air traffic control system over the eons of time, but it's not even come close to the impact of weather. So I would submit to you that our mindset needs to be, what are the symptoms? And we have dealt with some of the symptoms before and use that as a starting place for planning for how to move forward, just as a suggestion.
So then am I hearing you right that you are saying that we're considering a cyber threat on critical infrastructure to be kind of a boogeyman because we're calling it a cyber threat and it sounds spooky and scary when, in fact, yes, it's a big problem and, yes, it's something we'll need to deal with but not cataclysmic. Am I hearing you correctly?
It is a matter of just another version of some of the same threats. You know, power outages can happen for several reasons, an equipment malfunction, somebody not doing their job, some critical node breaking down or something, or it can be a cyber threat can cause that to happen or have it think it's happening. And so when you look at what we in the government, we call them COOPs, you know, continuity of operation plans. In business, we call them CRs, contingency responses, all those kinds of things. You have to think in, okay, what if X goes out? Now, it can go out for four or five reasons, and you must plan for each of the four or five reasons, but the effects of X going out is separate from the cause of X going out, and our planning's got to become more precise in that regards, particularly when it comes to cyber.
Dale Myros's most important federal news story of the week is from the New York Times. The headline is Cyber Attacks Against U.S. Corporations on the Rise, and it's linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. The most important federal news story of the week from Dan Blair is next on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
At BAE Systems, we always focus on keeping troops safe. One challenge military pilots face, it's called a brownout. When helicopter pilots confront dust storms or fog, the risk of collision is much higher. That's why we created a technology that lets pilots see terrain and obstacles through these conditions. Knowing our work helps to save lives inspires us every day. We'll be there on the next front. That's BAE Systems. That's inspired work. Learn more at baesystems.com/nextfront.
For over a century, Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington has served the youth in our nation's capital. The club's new STEAM initiative uses the arts to teach science, technology, engineering, and math. Today, more than ever, we need your support of STEAM. It will encourage our youth to think rather than memorize, create rather than copy, and to be resourceful rather than reserved. So visit boysandgirlsclubs.org. Send a dollar or more as an investment to help us help our kids pick up STEAM. Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Washington, great futures start here.
This message is brought to you by GEICO and Federal News Radio.
The Ballistic Missile Defense Report, provided by Raytheon.
A standard missile 3 Block 1B destroyed a complex separating short-range ballistic missile target during a Missile Defense Agency test this week, marking the 23rd successful intercept for the SM-3 program. According to Dr. Mitch Stevenson, Raytheon's SM-3 program director, the success keeps the SM-3 Block 1B on track for a production decision and deployment in 2015 as part of Phase 2 of the U.S.'s Phased Adaptive Approach for Missile Defense.
5 million hours of experience, 23 direct hit intercepts, unmatched engineering. Raytheon Standard Missile 3 is preserving freedom at home and around the world. Now Raytheon engineers are developing the next generation SM-3. When seconds matter and there's no margin for error, Raytheon Standard Missile 3 protects. In fact, there's nothing standard about it. Raytheon, customer success is our mission.
Kick off summer at the Safeway Barbecue Battle June 22nd and 23rd to benefit the Boys and Girls Clubs. 30 bands on three stages, including the Wailers and Roy Ayers on the Pepsi Next Lay soundstage, and Kristen and the Noise and EU on the famous Dave's music stage. Free food in Safeway's Sampling Pavilion, the National Pork Barbecue Championship, Rancher's Reserve Beef Contest, Purdue's Sizzlin' Chicken Contest, plus NBA Nation and lots more. Easy to get to by metro. Visit bbqdc.com.
Something that has not been sequestered are the Greater Washington Government Contractor Awards. Now in their 11th year, the awards honor the leadership, innovation, and commitment to excellence of the region's government contracting sector. In today's tough environment, boost your visibility by nominating your company or executive leader for one of these distinguished recognitions presented before an audience of 1,000 business and government leaders. Learn more and apply today at govconawards.com.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com, wrapping up this week's Federal News Countdown with the most important federal news stories of the week as selected this week by Dale Myros and Dan Blair. And Dan, your number one most important federal news story of the week. Well, first of all, I have to preface this. As we were just talking about during the commercial break, every time you're on the show, you pull one of the three stories just completely out of your hat, and it doesn't appear on the surface to mean anything to people who work for the federal government, and you always bring it home. So I'm pulling for you. Please, please don't leave me hanging this time. Your most important story of the week is from the New York Times. The headline is Greeks avoided taxes to the tune of 55 billion euros. And I need you to help me connect the dots here, please.
Here we go. Why don't the Greeks pay taxes? They don't trust their government. They don't trust a tax collection system. You know, we have issues of compliance here in the United States, but not anything like that they have in Greece. And we've seen what's happening to the Greek economy. You know, it's taken down the EU. It's taken down the EU. And so if you look at this, and if you look at the way the Greeks view their government and the lack of trust in government, that I think to me the big story of the week is this IRS scandal. And it, to me, is a fundamental issue of trust in government. And the more I know that they had the former acting commissioner up before the House Ways and Means Committee today. They had Russell George, who is the IG. I know Russell very well. He's actually an Academy Fellow. And I think that, you know, I don't know if that report is public yet, although it's essentially it's public. It's on a bunch of different websites.
It's out now.
But it raises fundamental questions of line employees performing their duties, and that we always get most of our scandals in government are at the top. Politicals acting badly. But it seems like lately that the most scandalous stories have been about the career folks acting badly. You had GSA. Now you have IRS. And I'm very concerned about this, that it can shake a fundamental trust in government. I talked about this with the chairman of my board at the Academy, Diane Disney, and she said, are we becoming Greece? You know, are we going to slip into becoming Greece? Because people don't trust the IRS. And people may not like the IRS. I mean, there was a movement afoot during the IRS restructuring bill that came out of Congress in 1998, and there was a big movement afoot, abolish the IRS. Well, you can't abolish the IRS. You have to have tax, you know. What was it? The Supreme Court justice that said taxes are the cost of a civilized society. I'm paraphrasing. I think it was Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. But you know, nevertheless, you have to have trust in the organization. You may not like the laws they're enforcing, but you need to have trust and faith in them enforcing them even-handedly. And this undercuts it. And it just doesn't get any better. There are a couple of other things that came out this week that I thought was interesting. Joe Davidson in the Post talked about the 10 deadly sins, that if an IRS employee commits one of these, that it's grounds for automatic dismissal. And I've never been a fan of these. I always think that, you know, you shouldn't be legislating these. These are something that an agency head or an agency should have the authority to do, but they need to be able to handle it themselves, like filing a tax return. We've heard stories that there were maybe interns who they didn't make enough income to pay taxes, but they hit the threshold to file. They didn't realize it. Then they're barred from employment. I mean, that's silly. Come on. It's a 19 or 21-year-old making a mistake, And you should be able to move on from that, and it shouldn't be legislated. Well, these things are going to be enshrined. I bet you Congress adds to these things. And is that good or bad? Well, I don't know, but this really is, it's Congress's reaction is going to be interesting to watch. I hope that what Congress does is actually address the problem. To me, it's a fundamental management issue. And yesterday's appointment of Danny Werfel, I know Danny, and Danny's an Academy Fellow as well. I wish him the very best in this job. But it's a huge management undertaking, and it's getting control of your line to make sure that these things aren't happening and that future things like this don't happen as well.
Dale, Dan is getting at something, too, that every agency deals with, and that is congressional mandates sometimes at least holding you back from accomplishing the mission that they've given you in the first place to accomplish for the people.
Absolutely. And in my 3.5 decades of government service, I often found that we end up with a problem, and then the cure for the problem ends up creating a bigger problem than what we had with the initial violation, as it were. I think Dan is on to both things. First of all, I do think that the element of crimes being committed by career civil servants is something for us to worry about, because that trust affects every story we've talked about today, and the citizenry and the trust that we have. But I think he's equally right that sometimes our decision on how to react not only exacerbates the problem, but can creates a considerable number of other problems that prevent future mission accomplishment.
The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Dan Blair, is from the New York Times. The headline is Greeks avoided taxes to the tune of 55 billion euros. And if you're looking at it later and trying to figure out how it connects, you can listen to this program archived at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. You did it, though. You brought it home. You pull it off every time.
I like my souvlaki.
Yeah.
And my Giro. So, I thought that was important.
Well, nicely done. It's terrific to have you on the program again, Dan. Great
Francis,
to see you as always.
Thank you very much. I'm always, it's always my pleasure, and I'm honored to be here.
I'm happy to have you. And Dale, the problem with you performing as well as you did on the Federal News Countdown is I'm going to ask you to do it again.
I'll be happy to, Francis. Thanks for having me.
Terrific to have you here today. All of the stories that we counted down today are linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, and we'll archive this show so you can listen to it later also. Hour number two of In-Depth with Francis Rose, right around the corner on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.